You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, our guest is Cheryl Tippins, author of Inside the Dream Palace, The Life and Times of New York's Legendary Chelsea Hotel, just published last December. Well, like a month ago. Ms. Tippins is also the author of, let me see if I can get this right, February House, the story of W.H. Auden, Carson McCullers, Jane and Paul Bowles, Benjamin Britten, and Gypsy Rose Lee, Under One Roof in Wartime America. Inside the Dream Palace, it's the story of a dream place, one that, in my mind, reached a critical mass kind of twice in the culture of America. First, when it began as the imaginative and beautiful concept of a place where all walks of Americans could live, work, recreate in the same and beautiful place, and, you know, a place with three-foot walls thick to protect privacy, a roof garden like the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, and apartments with 12 rooms and studios of one. So the plutocrats that we'll talk about and the regular work people could live in the same place and, you know, have relationships, unlike kind of the situation today. The second critical mass was when, during the 50s, 60s, and kind of 70s, when all types of artists and eccentrics, spirits of the best and maybe the strangest personalities of America, were able to congregate in one place, and the synergy of their presence far exceeded the sum of their parts. So it's not often in life that a place, a time, or a person creates magic. But here is a place that Cheryl describes where that magic of one kind or another lasted for, and may still last, for over a century. As Miss Tippins says in her dedication, the book is written for the denizens of the Chelsea, past, present, and future. And I do hope there is a future. So welcome, Cheryl. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Sam.
Why do you consider the residents of the Chelsea Hotel denizens rather than just residents? Is it because you feel like, as I do, the frequenters of that place are just as important as the people who live there?
Yes, exactly. The transient population it brings new blood into the hotel, and the constant circulating through the building, I think, is an important part of the social structure of the Chelsea. Tourists who come through, and visitors have come through since the building began. They not only bring in new energy from other parts of the country, but they also, through their appreciation of the culture there inside the building and of the building itself, they remind the people who live there full time of the value of the place where they live and of the work that they're doing.
It's like when I was listening to Talk at the Strand with the guy from the Alice Cooper band.
Uh-huh. And, yes, Dennis Dunaway.
Yeah, he's great. He looks really cool, too.
Yeah.
It's funny because he was talking about how it affected his life and his art. And, you know, how often could they have stayed? It's like the one-night stand with Leonard Cohen and Janis Joplin and the one song, which has now been remade and was just remade again last year. And it's amazing because, you know, 8 hours together, a part of American culture was built, you know?
Yeah, it's amazing the way aside from the intrinsic gossip value, you know, of the incident itself, it just seems to have struck such a chord in the imaginations of a generation. Just he's so beautiful. Because Leonard Cohen is such an incredible poet, he really captured that moment of the creative culture, that moment of the life for the American artists at the time and in that place that has, I think no one has ever expressed it as well as he did in that song.
Yeah, it's really funny because, and there's this singer I like, Lana Del Rey, she just redid it last year. Mm-hmm. And then if you think of like his song Hallelujah, it must have been covered, like, I don't know, 100 times. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you're right. This is kind of like an aside, but you're right. There's something about what he writes that just, I don't know, touches everyone.
Yeah, it's been interesting because, you know, my book has this Facebook page. And so I've been telling the story for the past year in kind of a graphic novel format. I've been, every day I put a few posts, you know, from the book, and I'm doing it in chronological order. And it's very interesting to me to see, you know, the strength of response I get to different ideas and when I present the stories of different people. And whenever Leonard Cohen appears in the story, the passion, you know, the attention that comes to him is so strong. It's so, he really seems to epitomize the Chelsea and, you know, the beauty of the artistic life for so many people.
I know, it's really funny because the temporal aspect of the Chelsea in terms of the people who move through it really isn't as important as the space, as the place that it is. It's you move through it, and as you... Well, talk about... I end up talking too much in these interviews. Why don't you talk about the another one-night stand, the one between Jack Kerouac and Gore Vidal?
Yeah, well, it was interesting. The Chelsea was created as a creative residence, artists, but also builders and entrepreneurs and theater people. You know, people who wanted to create a culture. That's who the architect was trying to attract into this building. So he put art studios in, and he put wonderful private soundproof spaces for writers and musicians. But he also, you know, he drew a collection of people from all walks of life, and that was the purpose of the building. And it had continued that way through generations, even though people forgot about the original architect and the original purpose. The way he designed the building ensured that the same types of people, similar types of people, would always be attracted to living there and visiting it. So by the 1950s, Dylan Thomas had found his way to the Chelsea through word of mouth, the poet, and had made it his second home whenever he was touring the United States. And he was idolized by the Beat poets, and including Jack Kerouac. And on the night that Jack Kerouac and William Burroughs were celebrating the publication of Burroughs' first novel, Junkie, they went out drinking, and they ran into the novelist Gore Vidal, and they all got really drunk, and Kerouac started flirting with Vidal, and until Burroughs got kind of fed up and left the two of them alone together. And so these two writers decided that they needed to consummate their relationship, and where else to do that in a historical way but at Dylan Thomas's American home at the Chelsea Hotel. So they showed up the Chelsea, they signed their names in the log with a flourish and told the rather bemused desk clerk that they were making history, that this logbook would be treasured by historians forever after, and they stumbled drunkenly upstairs and had kind of a mediocre one-night stand together.
Yeah, the funniest part of that is the fact that, and that's why the Chelsea is kind of like a time machine to me. They signed the register already knowing that in the future what they're saying is correct, and in the future that register actually will have some some monetary value, and yeah, they're already aware of it.
Yeah, it's, and like, they were young men, very young men at the time, and Kerouac had published one book, but he wasn't doing very well at the time. On the Road hadn't been published yet.
No, and Junkie, you know, before Naked Lunch and stuff. Yeah, you're right. And then you have, like, Bob Dylan, who names himself after Dylan Thomas. You know, it's almost, you couldn't, like, make a movie out of this if you didn't know, because no one would believe what happened there.
Right, and it does give people the feeling. I mean, that's why tourists still love it today, and even the people who live there. You know, you just do get the feeling of history when you move through the building. There are architectural reasons for that too. Yeah, the ideas that the architect was playing with when he designed the Chelsea were to sort of instill a sense of mystery in the building by having corridors that led to seemingly to nowhere, and curved walls and little hidden recesses and things like that, just to add to the personality of the building and the mystery, and that adds to that sense of you know, that you're entering a kind of time tunnel when you are in the Chelsea.
And I felt, you know, and that's another reason why, just like so many people are drawn into the book, because they've been there. And the weirdest thing about my trip there was, I live in Philadelphia. I was going to Woodstock, August 16th, 17th, and 18th of 1969. Uh-huh. I passed through there. It was just, all it was, to me, it was just drugs everywhere. Mm-hmm. And then I go to Woodstock and throw away my tickets because the fences were already down, and I wish I had kept my tickets.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, it was just, as you would have said then, a mind-blowing experience for me.
Yes, and Patti Smith describes that very moment at the Chelsea in her book, Just Kids, of walking into El Quixote restaurant, which is on the ground floor of the
right.
Chelsea Hotel. And, you know, there's Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, you know, a bunch of musicians who were on their way to Woodstock. And she just felt like, you know, even though she had not yet made her name for herself as an artist, she felt she belonged there, and that she, you know, that was part of the Chelsea's allure, is that you can be an artist there before you're actually an artist, which is part of the artistic process. You have to imagine yourself in that place before you can become that person you want to be, and the Chelsea opens its arms and allows people to do that.
And the interesting thing, one of the very interesting things, is when Andy Warhol filmed Chelsea Girls there, mm-hmm. what you in your book say Bob Dylan said, which was they might as well have just shut the place down then.
Right.
Where do you think that came from, and why is that true? I kind of understand it, but why don't you explain it to...
Yeah, I think, well, you think about what Bob Dylan was dealing with at the time. This is the time, the period when he was just becoming really famous and was having to deal with reporters in his face all the time. You've seen Don't Look Back, the documentary film. You know, you see how sarcastically he handled his interviews and his press, you know, meetings and so on, because he was really, really annoyed by all the attention, you know, he got, and all the stories that were incorrect about him and so on. And he saw that with the creation of Chelsea Girls, which was the most successful underground film ever made from this, you know, New York crowd, the Chelsea itself was becoming famous. So the Chelsea itself was going to get all of this attention and have to deal with all of the false stories and all of the, you know, the expectations, the false expectations, and having to live up to its legend and so on and so forth. And so he felt, you know, he either had a motorcycle accident or not, or he had one and may have exaggerated its impact. But anyway, he retreated to Woodstock himself, but the Chelsea couldn't retreat. It had to, you know, it had to deal with the fact that it now had a reputation as a, you know, really decadent drug den, you know, full of transvestites and, you know, heroin addicts and so on.
Yeah, but that's what America, and you know, you know your feelings regarding plutocrats and things like that. And I like the way you say plutocrats come and go, but we stay. It's very true. Uh-huh. But, you know, that's what America does, isn't it? Once, whether it's football or a movie or the damn Kardashians, whatever it is, once, and if, you know, being famous for not being famous or being famous for no reason at all, it changes everything. The substance
yeah.
kind of goes away, and I think that's what he was getting at.
Yeah, and that's that was something that I was really interested in examining in the book. What, you know, the how the interface between art and you know, a commercial culture. Well, it's, you know, the way each group helps the other. Because, for example, you look at Janis Joplin at the Chelsea. She got a huge amount of money for her first album with Columbia, but then she had to tour, and you know, she was under the pressure of doing all of these tours, like all of these rock musicians at the Chelsea. You know, the upside and the downside is very fascinating to me, to see how on the one hand you have this tool for getting your story or your song or your message out to the world. A tool that's more powerful than any humanity has ever had before, you know, coming from the United States with all its money and all its power. But on the other hand, to serve that master, you have to, you know, it destroys a lot of people. And then the same thing, in a sense, is happening to the hotel. Will the hotel be able to withstand all of the attention and all of the value that has accrued from its fame?
Yeah, and it's like with Janis Joplin, it's the perfect analogy because she becomes famous for her first album, and then she essentially abandons her friends and creates a second album with other people because she's being manipulated by producers and the media and all that, and then she dies.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And that's what happens.
And uh-huh.
America
yeah, and,
tends
know,
to do that.
It's so sad. Near the end of her life, you know, she was thinking, it was said, you know, Stanley Bard, the owner-manager at the time of the Chelsea, said that when he really liked Janis Joplin, and he said, you know, it was such a shame that she hadn't become the school teacher that she had originally thought she would become, you know, before she became a famous musician, that she would have lived a long time probably, you know, and had a happy, productive life. And as it was, she gave the world this amazing voice, this amazing music, but the price that she paid was so steep, and it was just, you know, the underside, the opposite side of the coin.
Yeah, but so many of those artists also paid, you know, incredibly steep, you know, whether it's Jim Morrison or whether it's mm-hmm. Jimi Hendrix, mm-hmm. you know, it's the same price. But then again, you know, there is something, and the Chelsea kind of embrace this in a certain way, there is something about, you know, burning out like that, like, you know, Russ Never Sleeps and Neil Young, mm-hmm. you know, it's and Sid Vicious, exactly. Mm-hmm. There is something about burning out at the height of your powers rather than ending up, you know, old like me.
Yeah.
And everything that happened is, you know, it's like Glory Days by Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a dilemma. It's like, you know what it's like? The lottery winner, one of the two lottery winners that just won the $300 million, the woman who came forward first, I looked at all her pictures before mm-hmm. she won, and she seemed so happy. She was in London with her husband, and she was having a party, and she was smiling. And I was thinking, you know, all this money is going to make her really unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
It's just going to change her whole life, and mm-hmm. that's what money does.
I know, it's so strange, and yet that's the American dream, you know? So that, yeah, I to me, that was why I wanted to write this book, that the hotel, to me, epitomizes so many of these ideas. And, you know, a lot of people who lived at the Chelsea during its heyday, you know, so on, they think, you know, it should just become a regular hotel now. As you said, like it had its the height, it should basically die, you know. So there is that sentiment even in terms of the hotel.
What do you think will happen to it? I mean, I've read all the articles, you know, mm-hmm. and the resales, and Mr. Bard being unceremoniously booted, and mm-hmm. and then, you know, the residents that are there aren't required to leave, and it just seems like nothing's happening now, but eventually I assume it will become like this really cool boutique hotel, but the place where, you know, Arthur Miller wrote After the Fall is not going to be there.
Right. I think, you know, as in a lot of cases in America and the United States, it may just come down to money. The hotel's being gutted, and there's still about 80 or 90 residents who legally are allowed to stay there, and they'll continue to live there. But the rest of the spaces are being renovated. The new owner, Ed Sheets, used to manage the Hard Rock Hotel in Las Vegas, so that is the worrisome aspect of his past. But on the other hand, he's become fascinated with the hotel's history, and he says he wants to vary the prices and the sizes of the rooms, just as was originally the case at the Chelsea. Whether the cheap ones will be cheap enough is questionable, but on the other hand, they weren't, you know, rock bottom prices either at the beginning, which was, you know, a kind of a problem at first. It was sort of middle class and above. Maybe lower middle class and above, but working class people still couldn't afford to stay at the Chelsea originally.
Yeah, well, maybe why don't you give a little bit of background into the commune aspect and how that, you know, how one man essentially decided this is what he wanted to do and create this diversity.
Well, the Chelsea was created by a Frenchman who had emigrated, who had fled France in, after the 1848 uprising. So they came over with a lot of sort of proto-socialist ideas. They were, the father had been an architect for the utopian philosopher Charles Fourier, whose ideas about how to live were used by the Brook Farm literary community in the 1840s in the United States. But anyway, it had a lot to do with the need to allow everyone's natural desires to flow freely, that the job of society was not to make workers work for the wealthy or to warp people's lives in any other way, but to allow them to live joyfully and freely. And in and the more diverse a society was, the more creative and interesting and exciting it could be. So the goal was to have representatives of just every type of personality that you could have sharing a space in order to share expenses so that you could spend less time making money to support yourself and more time enjoying yourself.
Who was the guy that that said, I don't know if it was the crazy guy, I've forgotten his name, who said, you know, you guys are so lucky because you don't have any money, so you have total freedom?
Yeah, I don't know who that was.
There's someone in the book. But the thing that reminded me of, like, my first divorce, when I left, I didn't take anything. I took a Pink Floyd banner, a director's chair, and an army cot.
You had a very interesting life.
Seems that way. But anyway, so like that first night when I just had those three things, the banner, the chair, and the bed, I had to go out and buy a pillow. I felt so light. I felt so free. And then I started collecting stuff again. And I realized I was happiest when I didn't have any stuff at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's you feel light on your feet almost.
Yeah. So this architect Philip Huberts, his goal was to make the nuts and bolts of life as easy to bear as possible, to make living inexpensive, and to arrange a building that had both private places upstairs for people to do their work uninterrupted, and but a lot of places for people, for the residents to socialize, and also, you know, artists to live in the same building as art collectors, and actors to live in the same building as producers, so you could get some creative energy going. And he himself wrote plays, and he wrote a play, moved in right away and wrote a play there, and lived among the people he'd chosen for what he called a home club. And he was actually the person who introduced the idea of cooperative living to New York. This was not his first cooperative, but it was his best. He thought it was his, he considered it his best experiment.
And then co-ops became a part of the New York culture.
Yeah, and then they became a way for the middle class to make a lot of money in real estate, which was the opposite goal of the original goal. But, you know, a lot of people have been very grateful for that aspect of it. But so the Chelsea still it provides that it did provide that service until recently when it was sold. You know that people live there now. You know, under rent stabilization laws, and they had a very sympathetic owner manager, Stanley Bard, who did everything he could. He would just put drop cloths down on rooms so people could paint. He carried people rent wise between projects. People got sick. He would let them go for months or sometimes even years, behind on their rent until they could get back on their feet. And he brought in services to help them and so on. And now, no one knows. The new, it's being renovated. The new owner says, you know, he's taking us on tours, and he's shown me a $1,000 room next to a large, glamorous potential $1,000 room next to a $200 small room with a view of an air shaft, for example. And he says he's going to have all of these rooms mixed, and he's going to have, like, refreshments set out in the wide hallways that were made 8 feet wide to encourage people to linger in them and chat. And he is going to have a McDowell Colony-type thing where he gives visitors to, artists free rooms, and, in the hotel, maybe half a dozen rooms, and performance space or exhibition space on the ground floor. He says he's going to do all these things. And, you know, so in a way, it's an artificial version of the Chelsea, but it was artificial when it was created as well.
That's true.
And people took it over and made it theirs.
It's funny, there's this hotel I stay in New York called, I don't know, maybe you know it, Pod. There's Pod 51, Pod 39. So the Pod on 51st, the rooms are incredibly small. You can barely get your suitcase in. And they have bunk beds for two and single bed for one. And then there's no bathroom. You have a sink. And then there's four bathrooms around the floor, your floor. And then there's four lights above your door. And when they're all lit, all the bathrooms are being used. When they're not, and I always get a room opposite the bathroom, and it's very nice. And they have a concierge. The downstairs is beautiful. They have a roof garden. Mm-hmm. They have a really nice restaurant. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of cool. It's very nice. And it costs $100 a night.
Yeah. And so let's say that you were an actor, a young actor, and that there were also 12-room suites in the same hotel. And, there was a film director on the fifth floor, and you gave a performance on the roof, you know, and he attended it. You know, that was sort of the idea of the Chelsea forever.
So talk a little bit about the roof and how it almost, the penthouse, that how it almost became like a salon, you know.
Yeah, the roof was great. The idea of this 19th century idea for the architecture of the building is that the public spaces where people can come in off the street are downstairs in the lobby. You can sit around in the fireplace. You can watch people come and go. But as you go up the central spiral staircase toward upward toward a giant skylight with the sunlight falling down on you, you're supposed to go up into sort of the spiritual realm of creativity. This was the philosophy of the architect. So up at the top of the building, from the very beginning, he designed it with this wonderful little promenade that goes the width of the building, which was about 175 feet, I believe. It's the width of seven city lots. So you could just take your children up there to play. You could just walk, you know, with your spouse, see the city view, and you could have. He wanted people to have readings there and concerts, and they did from the very beginning. And also, about a half dozen artist studios jut up through the roof. They're duplexes, and then each of those has a little garden area, the stairs going up onto the roof. And then there's a pyramid on the roof that he originally intended as a clinic, so that residents wouldn't even have to leave the building if they got sick. They could stay there and everybody could visit them. But it turned out it wasn't used as a clinic, I don't think, ever. It became an artist studio almost immediately. So all of these people were up on the roof, and there's even 1914, somebody wrote a poem called Roofland, an ode to the life on the roof of the Chelsea. His wife had just died, and it was sort of a longing for those wonderful times they'd spent there with their friends. And then in the 60s, they called it the Surf and Beach Club. They tried to get the owner to put a swimming pool up there. It was just a constant circulation of art experimentation. Arthur C. Clarke was there showing off all kinds of technological gadgets at the time that he was writing in 2001, A Space Odyssey. And so there was a lot of interaction among the artists, their ideas. For example, Arthur C. Clarke was talking to Allen Ginsberg about acid trips. He was talking to his friend Shirley Clarke, an experimental filmmaker, about communicating with other people through satellite technology, which, you know, the Internet, i.e., more or less the Internet. And, you know, long before these things came to be, they would have create, you know, experiments or have film screenings or concerts. The Grateful Dead played up on the roof at one point, you know, and that was sort of like the backyard of the artists. You know, you could go up there if you were from the street, you could go up in the elevator and probably go up on the roof up through the 1960s, but most people didn't know about it. So it was really where the residents mingled and really got to exchange the ideas that then showed up in their work, which is one of the most interesting parts of writing the book also for me, was to see how these ideas, you know, the ideas that I could see others, you know, who were in the hotel who I knew were friends with, for example, Arthur C. Clarke, were talking about alien visitations, or William Burroughs was there with his dream machine, which was a way to, you know, if it was like flickering lights, this cylinder with a light inside, and it was punctured with holes. So if you faced it with your eyes closed, the flickering lights would strike your eyelids, and you would have something like an acid experience trip. That was the point of it, without taking drugs. So he was trying to market this contraption, but it's very similar to the effect of the obelisk in 2001. And Arthur C. Clarke often said, you know, he tried to write with Kubrick in Kubrick's office in New York, and he just couldn't. He tried one day and then went back to his home, the Chelsea, because he said he needed his neighbors for inspiration. They were the ones who gave him his ideas. So that was a really great time, and all of this was taking place on the roof. Arthur C. Clarke lived on the 10th floor, and his friend Shirley Clarke, the filmmaker, lived in the Pyramid. You know, and they were both very sociable and loved to invite people up for parties. So that was where a lot of the energy took place. And now, you know, that with the new ownership, there is a question of what's going to happen to the roof. And that's one of the most sensitive issues attending the recreation of the Chelsea, because he is, you know, earlier there was an application to put a bar on the roof. And if you make it, again, if you make this, you know, a commodification, a commercial enterprise, most of the people who were mingling on the roof before couldn't have afforded an $8 Coca-Cola, you know. They wouldn't have been there. So are you killing the purpose of the roof by doing that?
That's a good question.
And also, you know, there are a number of studios that open directly out onto the roof. So basically that would be putting a bar in some of the residents' backyards. So we don't. There's no confirmation about what's going to happen to the roof. I don't know that the owner has decided definitively what he's going to do with it, or, you know, we don't know what the city will allow, but, you know, in terms of zoning laws. But the point is that different architectural aspects of the hotel are there for a reason, and it's all, you know, it creates a synergy. If you take out one part of it, who knows whether it will really work well enough to continue.
Yeah, I think synergy is the best word to describe everything about your book. But in fact, you've been talking about these collaborations. Let's just go through, and you touched on two of them. Well, one of them. Let's go through like three of them and just give a little synopsis of each. The first one was the Dennis Hopper and Terry Southern collaboration, and Arthur Miller's After the Fall and the fiasco that it kind of became, and then Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick. I mean, and then what they created are three of the iconic cultural, you know, pieces of the 20th century.
Right, yeah. Yeah, so, Terry Southern and his friends, you know, his friends had a long history at, you know, with the Chelsea, a long relationship. So even back when he was writing the book Candy with Mason Hoffenberg, Hoffenberg was often at the Chelsea. So Terry, even though he wasn't living there at the time, was often hanging out there. And, so of course the counterculture atmosphere of the Chelsea informed everything he did, and everything he did informed the counterculture atmosphere at the Chelsea. So that, yes, he's very much the Chelsea is very much intertwined with the Chelsea culture. And then he did stay there after he started working, writing screenplays in L.A. He did come and stay at the Chelsea for a while during the period, I think right after he was shooting, or right around the time he was shooting, they were shooting that film with Dennis Hopper.
Yeah, Easy Rider, right?
Yeah, Easy Rider, sorry. It was interesting that the hotel was in the center of Manhattan, because, Wall Street was so close. It was halfway between Wall Street and the uptown, you know, society world, and yet it was sort of embedded in the heart of the city, and it was its whole purpose was counter to everything else that seemed to be going on in New York. And of course Easy Rider and Terry Southern, and Dennis Hopper epitomized that. So it was really wonderful. You know, it's wonderful that the hotel and the people in it were tolerated, even if just barely, by the neighbors.
Well, one of the best things I think about the book are the asides you make, and one was almost like a chapter unto itself was Arthur Miller writing after the fall and not realizing who was his director or collaborator who he got pissed off at. Well, I forgot who it was.
Just see if I can remember his name.
I'm just
blanking.
Yeah, he was blacklisted.
Was
it Elia Kazan or was it?
Yeah.
Because like he's writing this play and it has nothing to do with the Chelsea at the time, I guess, but he never realized that what he was writing was so close to his relationship with Marilyn that it was kind of, and that his actress looked like Marilyn. Wasn't that strange?
Wasn't it bizarre?
Yes.
It was so strange. And he was so, I think he was just so caught up in the theme of what he was, of his play, or that he hadn't realized somehow how public his life had become. Because I guess as a writer before Marilyn Monroe, he could, you know, pretty much write about anything that was going on in his life, and all of his work, you know, was really inspired by his own personal life. But people didn't know his father, you know, they didn't know his brother, so they didn't know how autobiographical his work was before. But then, and it was right after, and then she died. You know, she committed suicide during his writing of After the Fall, and so
yeah, they worried about that. You know, it's like
yeah, and but, so then there were amazing photographs. Arthur Miller had by now married a photographer, Inga Morath, and there are amazing photographs of the actress who played the supposed Marilyn Monroe character.
Yeah, you have wandering. You have one in the book.
Yeah, there's this one in the book of them all, doing a read through the play. But there are also pictures of her shot through one of the interior doors windows, sort of wandering in the hall in a Marilyn Monroe wig. They're just really spooky. They just weren't sharp enough for me to include in the book.
What's so funny is that at the very end of it, you have Arthur Miller saying, "Hey, do you think people are gonna think this is about Marilyn?"
Yeah.
And Kazan is like, "You know, you idiot." It's like,
but his theme was his theme was personal responsibility, and again, he was influenced to some degree by his life at the hotel because the Nouveau Realiste and the pop artists were taking over the hotel at the time and having happenings and having this sort of playful, you know, poking fun at the modern culture. And Miller was really concerned that this flippancy they were abdicating responsibility for what was going on. And, this sort of relativism and moral relativism. And he was really concerned that by doing this, he understood the pop artist message, but he felt that by ignoring the mainstream culture in a sense or making fun of it, that they were abdicating their responsibility as artists to try to change it.
Yeah, you can kind of see where he was coming from because the same thing occurred in both The Crucible and The Scarlet Letter. They mm-hmm. were about a certain time and place, but they weren't really about that. That's not what he was trying to tell the readership.
Right.
He was trying to analogize to what was going on in America at the time.
Right. And through his marriage, he was trying, you know, he wondered whether he had done that, whether he had abdicated responsibility in his marriage to Monroe when he had walked away from her, you know, because of her drug use. He just threw up his hands and left. And so his question was, how responsible are we for other people? How responsible are we for our culture? How responsible were we when the Nazis were killing the Jews so recently in World War II? All of these things, he was so involved in all of these ideas, and he had been working for years and years and years on this play. It was only now coming together, and only now had become about Marilyn. You know, so I guess that's why he honestly didn't seem to realize that he was writing about his marriage until the shock of the negative reaction by the public when they saw it.
Yeah, and that was kind of like, it was tragic, but it was, part of it was funny, you know what I mean? I mean,
mm-hmm.
the fact that he was so, not deluded, but just, he just
yeah.
didn't see it. And then, I was just thinking his other play, The Price, is also very similar because it's all about personal responsibility and letting yourself not be a commentator on your own life, but actually taking your own life for yourself.
Yes, and also what you get for what you give. And he was writing this in at the time that, and in the place that the rock musicians at the Chelsea were dealing with the price of what they got.
Good point. Yeah.
And so that was why I named that chapter "The Prize," because it seemed, and there was Viva, you know, of the new Andy Warhol superstar who was being lambasted in the New York Magazine for, you know, just putting it all out there in her funny way, and she was basically being treated as a druggie, and you know, I mean, the artists at the time that Miller was writing the book were really paying the price. They were really just beginning to realize what the price was.
Yeah, for example, who was the other Andy Warhol protege whose name slips my mind?
Edie Sedgwick, yeah.
Yeah, who should have been, mm-hmm. and in today's world would have been a famous person, and her mm-hmm. her life was derailed by.
Yeah, and she died at a very young age.
Yeah, and she thought she was going to be, Bob Dylan was going to have a movie and she was going to be in it, and mm-hmm. yeah, mm-hmm. and you're right, it's definitely a price to pay.
Yeah, but that exposure and that, you know, the price of fame. So that was the price of fame then, and, you know, there are all kinds of, and that's a very American concept too, that
yeah.
there's a price on everything.
Yeah, you're right, you're exactly yeah. right. You know, and I'm bouncing all around, but speaking of bouncing, how did, like, you know, the photos in the book are great. It's the book is worth the price just for the just for the photos. But
by the way, that's one reason why I sort of laid out the story on Facebook.
Yeah.
I thought, if you have the patience, I've been doing it for a year now. I'm finishing this week, I think. But if you have the patience, every day I'll give you another little bit. And you can have it for free.
Yeah, I've looked at it, and now I'm going to keep looking at it. But what I was going to say was, you know, when you look at the photo credits, you know, you have Dominique Nabokov as uh-huh. a photo credit for the picture in Virgil Thompson's suite, who's the father
of... I'm so glad you noticed that.
Well, yeah, I know. He's the father of American sound, and she was the most, like, what most preeminent, prominent photographer for three decades, photographer?
Mm-hmm.
How does that happen?
Well, Dominique Nabokov, her husband was Nikola Nabokov, and he was a composer. So he was a good friend of Virgil Thompson. So they were often there, and they stayed at the Chelsea as well. So,
but it's so fascinating that the footnote that really isn't a footnote is the credit, you know?
Yeah.
There's the credit. And then you think in your mind, I wonder what was going on that night, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And exactly, what were they talking about? And like Gerard Malanga, who is the assistant to Andy Warhol, a couple of the photographs were taken by him, the photograph of Viva and the photograph of Patti Smith with Sam Shepard.
Right.
Yeah. So they were all there together. I mean, that's what's hard. It's hard to take in.
It's almost impossible, because, you know, you think of Patti Smith and Just Kids, which you know, take some information from, too. So you mm-hmm. got Patti Smith and Mapplethorpe, but then you got Sam Shepard, who becomes this incredibly famous and prolific person.
And then this poet, Jim Carroll, who then Patti Smith helped become a rock star.
And then he sings a song about people who died.
Yeah.
And then he dies.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, like I said, you couldn't make it up. It's impossible.
Yeah.
And I love that song.
Oh, I know. So do I. I played it so much while
me
I was
too.
Working on the book.
I just played it the other day, and it's like, you know, it's a true song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then the Basketball Diaries. I mean,
oh, so good.
Yeah, it's just, you know, when you read it, and especially for, like, if kids read it, they're not going to, I hate to say this, but they're not going to believe it.
I know.
It's really hard to believe. But that's why I think it's so important that people read this, because stuff like this doesn't happen. What I was saying in the introduction, it's like magic, isn't it?
Yeah, and it doesn't happen accidentally either. I mean, that's, you know, this is the second book I've written about little creative communities. And it really, I'm really struck and fascinated by the fact that it doesn't happen accidentally. There has to be a really specific balance of predictability and security versus the randomness of life coming in to foil your expectations and stir things up.
And the other thing there has to be is, well, there's Stanley Barr, but also his son is David, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well,
I mean, David was there for what, half a century?
Well, the person was David Bard Stanley's father. He was there.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay.
Yeah. So he was there for about 20 years, and then the son Stanley was there for about 50 years.
And he didn't really want to be there at the beginning.
No, it was the Mad Men era, and he wanted to work in a high-rise and have a big salary like his friends were doing, wear suits, you know?
Oh, tell about how when you were interviewing him, how he just kind of went off on you. He just had his little hissy fit.
Well, it was interesting because it was the first time I'd visited the Chelsea as a reporter, so I just told him I wanted to come and talk to him, and he does that every day. He's perfectly open to it. And so I went into his offices, and they were renovating his usual office. So it was in the back, and he was just in a big room with a lot of other desks, and I didn't know anyone, you know. So I went in and talked to him. I started asking him about his childhood, about his father. And all of a sudden, he just started going off about how the board of directors had kicked him off the board, and that they wanted to get rid of him because he was trying to protect the artists and you know, taking paintings in lieu of rent, and they said he didn't take care of the building. And meanwhile, this younger man came up and was trying to shush him and tell him to please stop talking to this reporter. She's, you know, you don't know who she's going to publish this for. And that was his son, David. But that was the beginning. So when I came in to start writing about the Chelsea, was the beginning of the end of that period. So over the next 2 years after I met Stanley, he was fired by the board of directors and kicked out after 50 years. And then 4 years after that, the building was sold.
And the thing is about him is that he's as much of the story in your book as anybody else, because he was not the captain of the ship, but in some sense he was the navigator.
I think that is the thing that he came to understand, was that to make it work, you couldn't be the captain of the ship. You had to be the facilitator. And it was interesting, he came from, you know, his father was really an old-fashioned type of hotel keeper, where, you know, what the customer wants, the customer gets, this very gracious thing. And he had originally just bought the hotel because it was a bargain during the Depression, but he got to know the artists and really respected them and became good friends with Virgil Thompson and Arthur Miller and Edgar Lee Masters and so on, and began to understand how the hotel worked. And so his natural hotelier sort of serving everyone, that attitude was passed on to his son. But Stanley was a very young man. He was, you know, like not even 20 when he started working at the Chelsea. So he was the same age as the pop artists who were there right after he got there. And they started teaching him about art and taking him to their exhibitions and their theater performances and so on, and their parties. So he became friends with them, really, you know, hanging out with them all the time. He was the same age. And so he took that, you know, naturally wanting to facilitate the lives of the guests, a big step further. And that facilitation was a wonderful thing for the Chelsea. It was also, you know, a bit of his downfall, because he didn't put his foot down ever, you know, or very often. He did at times. But, you know, and then he got slapped for it by the board of directors.
That's
eventually.
What happens.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wish I had someone around that would tell me to shut up. But I never, you know, that's what you need. That's like what Mel Gibson needs. It's what Tiger Woods needs.
You need,
and it can't be someone. And it's like Fame in America. It can't be someone that's your entourage.
Right.
It has to be some kid that went to second grade with you.
And right,
says to
exactly.
Tiger Woods, "Hey, Tiger, I don't think you should be texting, because I can find text. Maybe let me use my phone." Or, "Mel, if we get stopped by the cops, maybe you shouldn't get out and say a whole bunch of anti-Semitic things. You know, probably not a good idea." But it has to be someone that, you know, can say that to you.
But there was really a wonderful family atmosphere through all those years that Stanley was running it. Because, for example, Jerry Weinstein, who ran the front desk for decades, was a childhood friend of Stanley's. And, you know, like some of the residents who had children there, they said, you know, the first person to know when I was pregnant, was the switchboard operator, Amy, and so on. You know, and these were the people who protected the residents so that they could work. Like, they didn't, they wouldn't forward calls during their work hours if they were asked not to, and that sort of thing. And that's, you know, that's, it's like the writer's wife, you know, who keeps the reporters away and so on. It's an incredible service, and that is facilitation. It's not being the captain of the ship; it's being the facilitator.
Right. You know, I was going to, I mean, I know I'm saying this for the first time, but you must have been thinking this the whole time you were writing the book, is, can you imagine how much fun this would have been?
I know. I know. I never lived there, but when I decided that I wanted to look into it to write a book, I stayed there for a while, and, you know, temporarily. And I had thought at first that probably the Chelsea Hotel, you had to be pretty, you know, you had to be really cool to be accepted there. Like, it was one of the New York's inn club type places. But it turned out to be really the opposite. I was so charmed by how everybody was accepted there, no matter what they looked like, no matter how successful or unsuccessful they were, you know. It was the most inclusive feeling place I've ever been, and so friendly. And even all the, you know, all the staff there, you know, the, who are known for the, like, the cleaning women and the bellmen taking care of those who are become ill, or, you know, have, you know, mentally ill at times, and, you know, caring for them like family members, because, you know. So I got that feeling from the very beginning, and it was just so entrancing. It was just, there was just no place like it. So I didn't get to live there and have that experience, but I got a little taste of it at least now and then. And even in all the years since, you know, interviewing the residents there and, you know, going back and staying there briefly now and then, and keeping in touch with them daily, the kindness that they show to me as an outsider, and you know, in general to one another, is really family-like. It's really phenomenal, and it's such a warm place in the middle of what can be a very cold city.
You know, in the last couple of minutes we have, that is a good segue, because your introduction was as fascinating as the rest of the book, because you're waxing eloquently about how much you love it and this and that, but in the beginning of the book you're saying you had no interest in it at all. You didn't even see it when you walked by it. And you talk about how the Empire State Building is no longer really seen. You see where you live or where you first got your job, but you don't see the, I keep using iconic, but you don't see these iconic buildings. So why don't you talk a little bit for a couple minutes about, hey, you had no intention of doing this.
Yeah, I didn't. I stereotyped it in my mind, just, you know, the way you do the Empire State Building. Yeah, that place for tourists, you know, where they shoot movies sometimes. And and the same with the Chelsea, you know, it was just sort of this, you know, drug den or, you know, hippie place or whatever. And, you know, I just didn't ever think about it anymore. I used to go to parties there when I first arrived in the 70s in New York, and it was interesting and intriguing, but I just didn't think about it very much. And I didn't realize, like, when I went to the Museum of Modern Art and saw Jackson Pollock's paintings, I didn't know that they were connected to the Chelsea Hotel, or the Museum of Modern Art itself wouldn't have happened, you know, without one of the artists who lived in the Chelsea Hotel, Arthur B. Davies. So, you know, I had no idea. And one day I was just having lunch with a guy I had just met from England, the director of a music school from England, and Gavin Henderson, and I asked him where he was staying, assuming he was staying at some fancy place, and he said the Chelsea, and I was just taken aback. I asked him why on earth he'd be staying in that Fleabag place, and he just started telling me the story of his life at the Chelsea, which he considered his second home since the 1960s, and how Virgil Thompson had changed his life, and he'd named his firstborn son after Virgil, and just, you know, his mother said she wanted to go there to die. His entire family loved the Chelsea, and it didn't convince me initially to write a book about the hotel, but it did pique my interest, and then further research just completely floored me, and I thought, how could I have lived in this city for 30 years and not seen this place, and seen the phenomenal, it's the largest and longest lived artist community ever.
I know, it's amazing. And the funny thing is, you didn't mention the culmination of your decision to write the book was like something out of Ghostbusters. There's this lightning storm. Why don't you tell about that?
Oh, yeah. I had done some research in the library, and there were a lot of sort of bizarre stories that came up in the search engine initially.
About the lady who cut her hand off and left it for her daughter and then jumped out the window?
Yes, these bizarre suicides from the 1800s and early 1900s. And so those were kind of intriguing. But I still didn't want to write the book because I was working on something else. And then one day I was just walking through Manhattan. There was a big thunderstorm, and I was crossing 23rd Street at 7th Avenue and jumping over a puddle, you know, that collected around the curb. And just as I was jumping over it, I remembered that the Chelsea Hotel was half a block down that street. So I looked up at this Gothic hotel with the roiling storm clouds in the sky over it, and it was just incredible. It was like, you know, a Munsters, you know, image. And all of a sudden, lightning flashed right above it, this forked lightning right over the hotel, and the trees and the roof gardens were waving at me, like trying to get my attention. And I thought, okay, enough already. I'll stop resisting this. The hotel wants me to write about it.
You could have started the book, "It Was a Dark and Stormy Night."
Yes, absolutely. It was just a typically sort of magical little Chelsea moment. So I'm a romantic. I gave in.
Yeah, it was romantic. Well, I could go on and on forever because there's so many other characters I've written their names down, but we kind of have run out of time, and I always go over. So anyway, I highly recommend it. It's on the, you know, it's at Wellington Square Bookshop is my bookshop, and your book is prominently featured on our front table. And I recommend it to everybody. It's basically, it really is one of a kind. Not necessarily because you wrote it, although it's great, but because the Chelsea Hotel was, and hopefully will be one of a kind.
Yes.
So thanks very much for joining us. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, thanks very much, Sam. Thank you.
Talk to you soon. All right.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So that was great. I mean, and this book was really great. And plus, you know, like I said, I stayed there. I know it. It influenced my life as well as so many other people. It's just a really good book. It's not a novel. There's no fiction in it. It's all true. And the truth is much stranger than anything you could have ever made up about that hotel. I wish it was still the way it was, but it's not. And it probably, even though she says so, it probably never will be again. It'll be a boutique hotel like the Standard down by the High Line, have fancy bars, and you have to dress up nice to get in. But it'll never be what it was. It needs cockroaches and dust and great artwork. So anyway, how much time do I have? I got 1 minute. Okay, so as I've said on scores of occasions, with some luck, I suppose, Wellington Square Bookshop is located in the town center in Eagleview, just above the Brickside Grill, and two doors down from Nudie's Restaurant. It's a full-service independent bookshop, one of the few remaining, provides a community gathering place for all of Eagleview. The shop has numerous living room spaces and hosts many book clubs and community groups. Story hour every Tuesday at 10, open mic second Friday of every month, podcast on iTunes, this show. We have a cafe with lattes, cappuccinos, and espressos. It's nice to find a place where you can still hold the writer's soul in your hand and interact with a staff that relishes the beauty of the written word and the serendipity of searching for a book, recommend it, and finding another one that changes your life. Well, I got 9 seconds left. Next week, our guest may very well be Rachel Kushner, whose great book, Flamethrowers, is now coming out in paperback. So I thought maybe we'd rebroadcast her interview with us back when the hardback first came out. Okay. Thanks very much for joining us. I'm 6, 7, 8 seconds over, and we will talk to you next week.
You've been listening to the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.